One of my greatest values and priorities for holding both is to foster community. I offer multiple support and process groups that are held from the vantage point of an occupational therapist who specializes in mental health and women's health. I call these my support circles. In May, the Complete Circle begins. This group is tailored to those deciding to end their secondary infertility journey without a second child. This will be a safe space to hold gratitude for motherhood as it is, even though it looks different than one might have pictured initially. The topic of this podcast aligns with the theme of this group. If this is relatable to you and you would like more information, please email me at allie@holdingbothllc.com. That is allie@holdingbothllc.com, or follow the link in the show notes to learn more. Hi, my name is Allie. Welcome to the Secondary Infertility Podcast. I'm an occupational therapist with training in mental health, women's health, and health literacy. I experienced secondary infertility and loss myself, and I know that there is complexity in holding both the joys of motherhood and the pain and yearning that comes along with infertility at the same time. I want to be a conversation catalyst for this very important topic. Welcome. I'm glad you're here. Welcome back to the Secondary Infertility Podcast. I'm here with Jesse Jaskolski. After a devastating 22-week pregnancy loss that led to secondary infertility, Jesse spent years trying to complete her family and ultimately had both of her daughters through surrogacy. Through Jesse's journey to becoming a mom, she felt as if there was an obstacle at every turn. Jesse founded Surrogacy Simplified, a boutique surrogacy consulting and white glove concierge that helps intended parents start or complete their family through the selfless gift of surrogacy. Jesse takes care of all the details, big and small, allowing her clients to truly enjoy this pathway to parenthood. Welcome, Jesse.
Thank you.
Jesse, could you tell us a little bit more about yourself, where you located, and anything else that you'd like to share?
Yeah, I am in Baltimore, Maryland, and I have two daughters now through surrogacy. My youngest is a year and a half, and my oldest is four. And for fun, we like to spend time outdoors, going to all the playgrounds, and just cooking and baking together.
I love that. So I wanted to get into your professional background and your shift to entrepreneurship. I know that we talked and we both have something in common, that we're rehab professionals. So I'd love to hear your transition through your professional life.
Yes, I am a former speech-language pathologist. Particularly, my passion was in early intervention. And while I was a speech pathologist, I was working for a private practice that had contracts with infants and toddlers, and I loved it. And on the side, I opened my own private practice, which is probably where I got my entrepreneurial spirit. And then when I started walking through a very difficult path to motherhood, and like you had mentioned, just like feeling like there were so many obstacles everywhere I turned, I felt like I needed to do something with all of this information that I acquired along the way. Just decided to take the leap from helping kids learn to talk to now helping parents have children. And I opened my doors almost about a year ago.
Congratulations. I can't wait to dig and dive deeper into the surrogacy, just learning about it with you today, because I think it's going to be so valuable for people to hear more about the process. But before that, I wanted you to share what you feel comfortable with sharing your journey in terms of your pregnancy and what led you to surrogacy.
Yes. So I conceived easily and carried my pregnancy to 22 weeks. It was very uncomplicated. I felt great. So it was very shocking. I was actually on my baby moon with my husband in Arizona. And being on the East Coast, that means I was far from everybody. And we went out to dinner the night before. I had some stomach pain the next morning, which I was attributing to the restaurant that we had been to. And once I started bleeding, I realized that something was gravely wrong, and we rushed to the hospital. It had turned out I was in full-blown labor. Wow. And we tried to stop the contractions. The goal was at that point to try to get an amniocentesis and see what was going on. And they were unfortunately unable to stop the birth from progressing. I delivered at about 22 weeks. To this day, we don't know if it was preterm labor or if it was incompetent cervix that then caused the preterm labor.
Wow. Wow. I'm so sorry to hear that.
Thank you.
And so you delivered your son at 22 weeks, and this was in Arizona?
Yes, on
Christmas. This happened. Yep. Oh, my goodness. So after that, I know you mentioned that you experienced secondary infertility. Can you tell listeners why you experienced secondary infertility or how that came to be?
Yes. So a couple weeks after the delivery, I was home and I began hemorrhaging on my couch. And what turned out, I had retained placenta and I had an emergency DNC. And retained placenta can be quite common with an early delivery at 22 weeks. And what we didn't realize then was that the DNC was the catalyst for all of my secondary infertility. Like that operate, you know, the procedure on like such a raw uterus, like from just delivering, I ended up developing Asherman syndrome, which is scarring of the uterus. And I'm very much condensing years of testing and opinions and specialists just for the sake of time. But basically, I now had two obstacles. I had this, we were able to remove my adhesions and the scarring, but it had left my lining very thin. And for those listening, you may or may not know, you need a nice thick lining for your embryo or just for, to conceive, truly. And so we had this, you know, I had to get pregnant, but then also stay pregnant and make it past 22 weeks and hopefully get towards viability. And we were in this sort of gray area where the doctors wouldn't give a recommendation one way or another, whether we should move to surrogacy. But my husband and I felt like emotionally, physically, it was just a lot on my body, on the both of us to, even if we were to get pregnant, the chance of another late loss. So we took everything that we knew and decided that moving forward with surrogacy was the best path for us.
Wow, that dealing with a diagnosis and grieving a loss at the same time, I can imagine that would be so heartbreaking and so challenging while making that decision to move to surrogacy. I know that's not a decision many couples take lightly because of everything that goes into it. Did you have a guide to help you get started with surrogacy on your path, or did you go about it knowing someone who had done it before?
We knew several couples that had used one agency in particular. So we contacted that agency right away and we started to move forward in the process. But I would say that this was probably about 3 years after my loss because of all of the time getting second opinions and trying different procedures and surgeries. So we hadn't researched surrogacy in the initial stages, but we were still kind of trying to figure out what had happened to me following the loss.
Okay. And then once you went to go in, once you knew that you were going to go the surrogacy route, how did you get started? I know you said there was an agency that you were familiar with or that you knew people that were familiar with it. Did a friend or someone that you knew guide you to get started, or did you reach out to the agency yourself?
We reached out to the agency ourselves, and like, it's interesting because this is kind of like where the wheels start turning a little bit with my business that, you know, the agency did such a lovely job in my journey. They connected me with a gestational carrier, but there was still so much research to be done and still so much little details I had to do myself, which I enjoyed doing because it made me feel like I was contributing and part of the journey and, you know, working towards having my child. But it was definitely of work and very complicated.
Yeah, I can imagine. So in terms of the surrogacy process, I know that like some of the things that I've been learning from following you is that there's a lot involved up front. I know that I saw that there's an escrow involved. And for me, the only time that I've ever used an escrow is with purchasing a house. Can you tell me how that process works?
Yes. So that part of the process is, I guess, like a little bit down the road. So you would have already have identified your surrogate and she would have been evaluated by the fertility clinic and approved. And then you would have entered your legal phase.
Okay.
And in the legal phase, once you have created a legal contract and the contract's been signed by both parties, the intended parents and the gestational carrier, you would then open escrow. And that is where the gestational carrier's compensation is going to be put into and then dispersed to her at a cadence that's determined in the contract. And it can also help be used for like reimbursing, in addition to compensation, reimbursing her for medications, mileage, travel, anything like.
Okay. So wow, that's a lot. I think I want to go back to, in terms of surrogacy and educating people on the common terms that you would see. So, you know, gestational carrier, intended parent. Can you tell me some of the common terms in surrogacy that people might not know if they're not familiar with surrogacy?
Yes. So gestational carrier, as you mentioned, it is the person who is carrying the baby. Oftentimes, it's used interchangeably with surrogate, and it's generally referring to an embryo that is not biologically connected to the surrogate. So oftentimes, it's the intended mother's egg or a donor egg with the intended father or donor sperm, depending on the circumstances. Traditional surrogacy is not really that common anymore. It's actually banned in many states. And that would be when there is a biological connection with the surrogate. It's her egg and then either donor sperm or the intended father's sperm.
Okay. Yeah, I was reading that there are some terms that are outdated that people don't use anymore. Like one of them, I think, was surrogate mother.
Yes.
What are some other terms that you can think of that maybe aren't used anymore?
I would say surrogate mother is probably the biggest one. And a lot of people will use it. And it's actually interesting because it's so commonly searched in other countries that other people will use it just for like Google and SEO purposes.
Yeah.
But in fact, in the intended parent community, we actually don't like that term at all because it's using the word mother is almost making it seem as if there's like a biological or like a genetic attachment between the surrogate and the embryo, and there is not. So definitely the preferred term is just to drop the mother and go with surrogate or use GC. I think that's the biggest one. That nothing else is coming to mind as like a taboo term, so to speak. I would say when I began my first surrogacy journey, I wanted people to refer to my surrogate as a gestational carrier instead of a surrogate because I wanted them to realize that my daughter was biologically mine. But now with celebrities discussing surrogacy and just that being so much more common, even within the last 4 years, I feel like there's a total shift and people know when you're using the term surrogate, you're referring to gestational surrogacy as opposed to traditional surrogacy.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. I have taken the time to get to learn about surrogacy and I feel like there's so much to learn and so much to explain to people.
Yeah.
And so that's why I'm so glad that you're here today.
Thank you.
So in terms of when you got started with your own journey, was it a lengthy process to find the carrier, the gestational carrier?
It took about 3 months, our first journey, which is actually short. This was pre-COVID. Now I would say the wait times have expanded quite a bit. Now we're looking at probably closer to 6 months to a year, sometimes a little bit longer, depending on the agency. However, I experienced my surrogate miscarrying. And typically, if a surrogate miscarries, you would try again with her. But in my circumstances, the surrogate miscarried because the IVF medication brought out an underlying thyroid issue. So we needed to break our match and start from scratch. So for me, so we had then, you know, lost an embryo and also like a lot of money based on like paying for everything up until that point. And when we went to go match again, it was another couple of months to get matched. But we had lost all of the time from waiting to be matched with her and then going through the process with her and having to start again.
Wow. Wow. I'm sure that that brings such an emotional component into it with her loss and you experiencing your loss. And was she nearby or were you going to the appointments with her?
So whenever you're in a surrogacy arrangement, the surrogate's going to travel 2 times. She's going to travel once to the intended parent's fertility clinic for an evaluation, and she's going to travel the second time for the embryo transfer. Usually, typically, the fertility clinic's local to the intended parents, but sometimes the circumstances are a bit different. So I had been with her for the evaluation and the transfer, but not her outside monitoring appointment. So she was actually in Utah. And I was in Maryland, so I was not with her during the time of the miscarriage, which was about 6 weeks.
Okay. Wow. And then I'm going to jump forward a little bit too. When surrogates, when they deliver, is it typically where they're at?
Yes, always.
That they deliver. Okay.
And as a matter of fact, tying back to the legal component that we were talking about a little bit ago, you follow the law of the state where the baby's going to be born.
Okay. And I know something, I'm from Michigan, and I remember I was following someone who had a baby via gestational carrier in Michigan, and there was some disruption with the law in terms of being told that they needed to adopt the baby after the baby was born. Do you see that happen often, or is that pretty outdated, I would assume?
Yeah, that's outdated, but Michigan is currently, so gestational surrogacy is legal in 47 out of the 50 states currently, and Michigan's one of the ones where it's currently legal, but depending on when this airs, like there's being progress specifically in Michigan, and we are making gains towards it being legal soon. That being said, I would not recommend a surrogate that resides in Michigan at the time, given that it's not legal. You always want to be sure that where the surrogate lives, it's a surrogate friendly.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. I think the person that I'm thinking of, it was a family member that carried. So in those type of states, the three states that are outliers, can you have a carrier then that's a family member or a friend and you just don't go through an agency? How does that work?
I think I would still recommend just not moving forward in a state that's not surrogacy friendly, because you just want to do, like, you more likely than not, you've already just been through so much and you just want everything to be ironclad and like know that you're going through a state where this is legal and that you're not going to have any issues with the baby being, you know, being able to take home the baby.
Yeah, that makes sense. That's so valuable to know. Off the top of your head, do you know what the other two states are?
Nebraska and Louisiana.
Okay. Well, it's incredible. Hopefully, by the time that this airs, there will be some progress in those states, just because I feel like that's so important. And it stands out that there's only three that are a little bit. So for your second surrogacy journey, did you use the same gestational carrier? Did you use an agency? How did that work?
So no to both. My gestational carrier for my oldest daughter developed preeclampsia, and we had to deliver my oldest 7 weeks early. So we had a NICU stay. We had some hospital bed rest where my husband and I took care of the surrogate so her husband could support her children. And that is a disqualifier, right? Because we want to make sure that the surrogate is, you know, really healthy, and we're trying to decrease any chance of the pregnancy being high risk. So she was not able to carry for us, even though we loved her and still do and keep in touch with her. When we made the decision to have another child, we had thought about how it had taken us so many years for our oldest that we began thinking about it on our daughter's first birthday. And this was 2021 and the height of COVID, and most surrogacy agencies were not quoting wait times at this point. And so I figured that I was just going to try myself and do an independent journey and see if I was able to find somebody through use of social media, and ended up joining some private Facebook matching groups and found somebody and the process myself.
Wow. That probably taught you so much in terms of getting started with your business.
Yeah. I feel like the work I was putting in with the agency, like I said, the agency did such a lovely job, but it's still just such an incredibly, you know, complicated process on top of doing an independent journey and just having that entrepreneurial spirit in me that I wanted to give back in a way and share, make this process better for others. I was like, okay, I got this. Like, it's time to just start.
Gosh, that's incredible. So you mentioned Facebook groups and social media being a way that people will get initial contact with a gestational carrier. Can you tell our listeners what qualifies or what disqualifies someone from being a gestational carrier, in case there's someone listening that's interested in possibly doing that in the future?
Yes.
What are the requirements?
Yes. So it's always going to vary a little bit, because you follow, even if you're working with an agency, they might have their own criteria, but ultimately they're also going to have to meet the criteria of your individual fertility clinic. Generally, it's going to have a requirement about their body mass index, the number of pregnancies they've had, number of C-sections they've had, their prenatal history, if there was any complications. any history of mental health illness. And then also we're going to make sure that they have financial stability and they're not on government assistance. And the reason for that is because we want to make sure there's no coercion and they're doing it not because they're in a vulnerable state and that because they really want to help somebody else.
Okay. So you said it varies a little bit state to state or clinic to clinic, but those are the main things that are typically consistent across the board.
Yes.
Okay. And would you say that social media is one of the main ways that people find their matches or people make connections?
If they're going to go independently, yes. I would say there's lots of private Facebook matching groups. For an example, one is called like Surrogates and IPs Match Group, like just like what the name suggests. Okay. And there's a couple like that. And people are beginning to also create Instagram profiles where they're documenting their journey and they're also looking. I don't have like the data to share like how successful Instagram is going, but I think Facebook has been very, very popular. And now there's also popping up, which is different from when I had my youngest. It just things are constantly changing. There's some website platforms. An example is Nodal, Nodal. And you can match with somebody similar, like a dating, but then they wouldn't manage your journey. So it's a cost savings because you're getting access to a pool of surrogates, but you're saving money in that it's much less expensive compared to an agency.
Okay. Oh, wow. That's so interesting. Will you repeat the name of that app?
Yes. Nodal.
Okay. And so with Surrogacy Simplified, do you help with matches?
I do not. I guide and consult the entire way. So I help two buckets of parents on an independent journey and intended parents on an agency assisted journey. So for the parents on an independent journey, they might have a family member, friend, or they've matched using social media, and I coordinate the entire process on behalf of the intended parents. So I coordinate the psychologists, the legal, the fertility clinics, the outside fertility clinics for the surrogate, escrow, health insurance, travel, all of the different pieces of the puzzle. And then they also have the 24/7 access to me, just knowing how it felt. I was going through it sometimes. You just want to talk to someone who gets it, or you have a question. And, you know, sometimes everybody's so busy that you can often responses can take 24 to 48 hours. And I truly, since I've walked it, know how long that feels. So I try to get back. Like, I'm very responsive with my clients. Those on an agency journey, the agency will tend to do some of the case management that I also offer, and they will match the surrogate to the intended parents. But I do all of the little things. So the relationship management between the GC and the IP, the gift curation, the traveling, the passport, the birth certificate, all of the different things that are involved. Like, there's like the big details and then a million little details. So with them, I work complementary to the agency and tend to all of the little things that are involved in a journey.
Wow, that's incredible. You said something about gift. Is that the money that the gestational carrier will get from the gestational carrier will receive, or is that something different?
So that will be tied into escrow, and escrow actually receives a copy of the legal contract, and they're pretty independent with disbursement of her compensation. But when I'm referring to gift curation, this is of course optional since surrogacy is so costly. But oftentimes you might give your surrogate gifts, perhaps her birthday, the holidays, you know, maybe for the transfer if you're meeting her for the first time at that time, or, you know, when upon delivery, it's very common to give like a thank you gift, like a push present. So
yeah,
their kids' birthdays, like these are those little details that I'm talking about that all add up to making the process like so many things to manage. And I will help step in and take care of all of those like little gift ideas and everything in between.
That's incredible. It just seems like that's such a special touch in such a complex journey. So in terms of the insurance, do you find that there's ever complications with insurance? I know that I would assume that the gestational carrier's insurance would be covering most of the expenses in terms of the healthcare. How does that work?
Yep. So early in the process, probably during the legal phase, we'll go ahead and evaluate the surrogate's health insurance. And that's going to give us an idea of whether or not her health insurance is surrogate friendly. And what we end up doing is there's insurance companies that specialize in this. We will send them the 100-page explanation of benefits document of the surrogate's health insurance. And they will make a determination on whether they feel like the pregnancy will be covered by insurance. And if it's not, we would then purchase them a private health insurance plan. If you're lucky, sometimes it happens during open enrollment, and that can save about $15,000. So that's really great when your timing aligns with open enrollment. It's not always the case. But yes, I have a hand in all of that with the intended parents and coordination of all of that.
So could you give listeners an idea? I think that it shocks a lot of people, the cost. I know that it can vary widely, but a little bit of the cost, just a background of how much surrogacy can cost.
Yep. I would say it's going to run you anywhere from $100,000 to $200,000.
And so
I know I just shared $100,000 range, which is so huge. I can share a little bit of why the range is so great. One of them, there's a couple main bullets. One is the health insurance. So as I just described, we can be talking $0 or $30,000. So right there, that's the second one would be the surrogate's compensation. So what I'm seeing these days is $35,000 to about $60,000, which is another $25,000 range right there. Surrogates in California are sometimes asking upwards of $80,000, which I think is a lot. I think that might be a little high, but you know, what to each their own. And there's also, they set their compensation based on a few things. One is cost of living in their state. One is if they have, sometimes they'll set their cost higher if they know they have surrogate friendly insurance, because they know the intended parents are not purchasing additional insurance. Also, they'll take into account whether or not they're a first or second time surrogate. Some agencies let the GC set their compensation rate themselves, and the intended parents have the option to accept it, negotiate, or, you know, try to match with somebody else. Or they just say, okay, our first time, this is their base pay. If they're a first time surrogate, this is their base pay if they're a second. So there is variation. The third, I would say, is if whether or not you do an independent journey, agency journey, or use a consultant. You're doing independent, you're not paying anyone for that case management, so it's zero. Consultants tend to range anywhere from $8,000 to $12,000. And agencies can range, I would say, anywhere from $30,000 to $50,000 up.
Okay. It's really helpful to hear that breakdown because, yeah, like you said, when you get the $100,000 difference.
I know. I answer that question all of the time. And I'm like, I feel so bad because that's like, how do you plan for like a $100,000 discrepancy? For me, my first journey, as I had mentioned, we broke a match. So on top of the emotional component, we had already paid for an embryo transfer, a surrogate's medical evaluation, her psychological screening, opening an escrow account, and like her first transfer compensation. So we had lost all of that money that you can't recuperate as well. So sometimes things like that happen too, and that can, you know, then you're starting over and you're not able, like I mentioned, recoup those costs. So, you know, we had probably lost maybe $20,000, maybe a little bit more, having to rematch and start over.
Wow. Yeah. That emotional component of the loss and the loss of finances is such a, I can imagine, is so much at the same time.
Yeah, absolutely.
I was wondering too, after the baby is born, I know that some surrogates breastfeed. And so, or pump. And do you see that in your agency or in your business at all in terms of how that works?
Yep. It depends on matching preferences. Some people would prefer breast milk. And if they do, we can work with the surrogates to make sure that's getting shipped. So yeah, it really just depends. And then they would be, of course, compensated for their time for pumping and then reimbursed for the shipping of the breast milk, which is definitely costly.
Okay, so that is something that you can coordinate for people if they were to. Okay, wow, that's incredible too. Do you find that most surrogates do that, or is it just completely up to preference?
Yeah, I would say it's a mixed bag, and I've actually had experience in my personal life with both. My first surrogate was open to breast milk. I mean, I'm pumping, and she shipped it to us for a couple months. And COVID hit, we were like, okay, let's just stop. We were getting scared of everything.
Yeah.
And then second one, when we were matching, our gestational carrier said she wasn't interested in pumping. And to us, that just wasn't a deal breaker. So we were comfortable with just formula feeding from the beginning.
Okay. Yeah, it's so helpful to see both of the different options.
Yeah.
What are some reasons that someone would use a surrogate? I know that across the board, I know that you shared how you got to surrogacy. What are some other things that you see in terms of why some people go the surrogacy route?
Yep. So same-sex couples, particularly men, of course, they need a surrogate if they want to have a baby genetically connected to them and create embryos and all of that. Some women with MRKH, like the absence of uterus or small uterus, they need a surrogate. A lot of cancer survivors, they will, you know, it's becoming more popular now to like preserve eggs if they can before they begin treatment. And then depending upon where their cancer is, they might not be able to carry again. A lot of women with some endometriosis, all, you know, PCOS, just depending on like the severity, sometimes they need to turn to surrogacy, but not always, of course. People with recurrent loss that don't understand, like they might not have a reason why they're just, you know, continuously having loss. They're sometimes a candidate for surrogacy as well. Asherman syndrome, like I have, the scarring of the uterus. And also something I have learned since opening my business is actually that mental health conditions can also qualify as a reason to move forward with surrogacy. The most common one people might have heard about recently is Paris Hilton coming forward and saying that she used a surrogate because she had experienced sexual assault when she was in boarding school. And she was just kind of traumatized. And the thought of the frequent doctor appointments and being all of the extra examinations felt really scary. And that is actually a reason. Not just specific to that, but like mental health conditions where it might not be safe to go off of your medications or just because of trauma you've experienced. That would also be a reason to pursue surrogacy.
Okay. Wow. Yeah. I think it's so valuable when celebrities can share reasons why they're led to surrogacy, and there are reasons that maybe I or anybody else might not have thought of right off the bat, because typically I would think of like the first couple that you listed, the same-sex couples or someone who has a reproductive health condition. So I think it's really powerful to know that mental health, just anything with mental health or anything with a background of sexual trauma, can be a reason for surrogacy. So
yes,
that's pretty amazing to know that. In terms of your business, I know that you said that you learned some things along the way. What are some of the most valuable things that you've learned, or some of the things that you might have not known as an intended parent that you know now?
A couple things. One would be I think a lesson would be not something I didn't know, but just like a lesson was being an advocate for yourself, particularly if you're in the boat where you're just longing to be a parent and the days just feel so long. There's different times where there's like a lot of hurry up and wait, and just being really on top of the process to help it go smoothly. That's where I would step in if somebody's working with me. But if it's somebody just listening and wanting some advice, I would say being an advocate, staying on top of things just to help things keep moving along is really good advice. Thinking about the relationship you want to have with your surrogate ahead of time is really, really valuable too, because it's going to help you have a good journey later down the road. So thinking about things that might be non-negotiables for you. As an example, I don't fall in this category, but some people want someone who has a really healthy lifestyle, or they want them to eat a certain way, and you can set any criteria that's important to you. I just tell intended parents that you might be casting a wider or a smaller and making it, you know, maybe more difficult or easy to match depending on the criteria that's important to you. My most important criteria was somebody that would be willing to communicate a lot with me. Coming from my loss and then a surrogate having a loss, communication and being able to text frequently was really important. And I wanted to be matched with somebody who wouldn't find me annoying, but would welcome that. And would, you know, a friendship.
Yeah.
So I would just say thinking about those things ahead of time so you can match accordingly and then have a much smoother journey.
Yeah. Oh, wow. It's interesting too. I love what you said about the frequent communication. If one of the listeners or any listeners are intended parents, what would you say was something that in terms of your journey made you feel more connected to your baby when you're an intended parent?
I really enjoyed when the surrogates told me they had a craving or a food aversion more commonly. They had more food aversions than cravings. It made me feel part of it. I know sometimes people aren't sure whether or not to share that with intended parents because they don't want to make particularly intended mothers feel bad that they're not having that experience. But to me, I had felt so relieved that I was putting my embryos in the best chance to succeed that I didn't have any, I didn't experience jealousy or, I mean, some people may, that wasn't my experience. I enjoyed that because it made me feel really included and part of the process. I would also say like when they send pictures or shared moments of, you know, feeling kicks, I just love that. It made me just really feel like I was locked in. We did also, our surrogates weren't local, so we did travel for some of the bigger appointments like the 12 and the 20 weeks. So we could, especially the 20 week, I would say, because that's a really fun one when you start to, you know, they do the anatomy scan and you see all the different body parts. That would definitely be one, I think, that would help somebody feel connected to the pregnancy.
Yeah. You mentioned that some intended parents might feel some jealousy. What would you say to those who are experiencing that and normalizing that?
I mean, I would just definitely say just to have some, you know, peace with yourself, or, you know, grace is a better choice of words. I would grace with yourself and recognize that that can be a normal feeling. There's lots of support groups available and resources to help, you know, manage that. And, you know, just also keeping in mind that you made this decision for a reason and you're helping your embryo, you know, give the best chance of a nice, viable, healthy delivery.
That's great. That's great advice. There was one video that you posted recently. I believe it was for your daughter's birthday.
Oh.
And I loved that video. I felt like it was such a vulnerable share, such a beautiful video. Can you tell our listeners about that video and what was going through your mind?
So anyone's welcome to follow me. I post lots of resources. It's Surrogacy Simplified, just like my name. And it's the first moment that my daughter's placed on my chest. And it's my oldest one. So it's years after like the 22-week loss, the miscarriage. I had a chemical pregnancy I didn't even throw in there because the story, you know, I was such a three. And surgeries and you name it, just so much heartbreak. And it was just like this most visceral, like raw moment. I was like screaming. I took out the audio just so you can see my facial expression, but like I couldn't even believe that it was finally happening for me after all of these years. And then she came 7 weeks early, so it took a little bit till she could be placed on my chest. We had to get her evaluated by the NICU team, but it was just like such an unforgettable moment.
Oh my gosh, yeah, that video made me tear up. It was just such a powerful video. And for people that aren't familiar with the surrogacy process, it's just seeing those type of videos or those pictures from that first moment that the intended parent gets to see their baby, or that the parent gets to see their baby.
Yeah.
It's just so powerful. With your second daughter, was she, what was her birth like? Was she born preterm or?
She was born at 37 weeks through C-section. Our surrogate also developed preeclampsia, but much later and not as like scary in terms of how high her blood pressure was getting. So we were able to make it to 37 weeks and we had a scheduled C-section. And it was a very different experience in terms of that it wasn't, nobody was like really nervous about like what the, how our daughter was going to come out. Whereas with Lily, we didn't know like what kind of breathing support she was going to need coming that early. So there were some differences on that. And coming in for a C-section, we knew the date she was going to be born. So in terms of planning, I mean, that was very convenient and really nice. And the hospital was just fantastic. They had country music blasting because that was our surrogate's favorite genre of music. And they kept calling it my daughter's birthday party in the OR. Aww. It was just like a very fun, like lighthearted, even though we were in an operating room and there was a major surgery going on experience.
That's incredible. That's so special too, that they played the music.
Yeah.
Your daughters, what is the age gap between your daughters? And did your oldest daughter know what was going on and that she was going to have a little sibling?
Yes, they're 2.5 years apart. And she did. I mean, we would read books to her during the pregnancy and we brought my daughter to the 32-week appointment so she could see like, you know, our surrogate with a big belly. And we kind of talked about that the baby was in her belly and all of that. And we set up a nursery much later than probably the average couple sets up. We probably set it up around the 32-week mark because of what we had been through. So we had her involved in the building of the crib. And even though, you know, she's just like touching the hammer a little, like to her, yeah. She said to this day that she helped build our daughter's crib.
So special.
So, just so she could feel included because she wasn't seeing me go through any physical changes.
Yeah, it's so special to have her included have her feel like she's involved there. Yeah. As your daughters get older, I know, or I would assume that because of your business and because of everything that you've gone through yourself, that you will be very open with them about how they came to be. And could you tell listeners how you plan to share that with them more and more as they get older and that?
Yeah. So I have, so my 4-year-old actually knows already. She knows that we had a loss and she called and she talks about her brother and she asks me questions. And she knows that after that loss, we decided that it wasn't safe for mommy to have a baby. The way we've explained it to her is like, mommy had a surgery and, you know, we took something from daddy and we, you know, you grew in our Amber's belly. And it's like, she'll tell people this, like she, like in her mind, like we made it as black and white as we could. Yeah. And like, she gets it to an extent, like that she says she grew in somebody else's belly.
That's amazing. And then as they get older, I'm sure they'll be able to grasp it more and understand it more.
Yeah.
But I think it's so special and so important that you're starting off from when they can understand, like you said, the black and white terms. That's pretty awesome. What would you tell listeners who, what is one of the bottom lines? Like, what would you like listeners to know, or people in general? What is the bottom line with surrogacy? What is the most important thing that you want people to know that might be a misconception, or one of the most important things that you'd like to communicate about surrogacy?
That it's a really viable way to have a child if you're struggling with any of the issues that we've discussed, that it's a long process, that it can be complicated, but it's so beautiful. And it really is the most selfless gift that these gestational carriers do to help complete a family. It's just really beautiful and so unbelievable.
It's so interesting and so beautiful to learn about. And like I said, seeing the pictures, seeing the videos and hearing the stories has been so powerful. Where can listeners find you? I know you said that you have an Instagram page, Surrogacy Simplified. Where else can they find you if they're looking?
They can go to our website. It's surrogacysimplified.com. I have a free ebook available and it has a lot of really nice information for those who, you know, instead of also just listening to this podcast, like would like to see everything laid out. So I would highly recommend taking a look and downloading that. And then I also do offer an initial complimentary consultation. So people are more than welcome to sign up for that. My email is Jessie, J-E-S-S-I-E, at surrogacysimplified.com. And then I'd say the other way would be LinkedIn under my name, though, Jessie Jaskolski. And my last name's a mouthful, but it's J-S-K-U-L-S-K-Y.
And I will make sure to link all these in the show notes. And I wanted to conclude with a question that I ask all of my guests. What makes you you outside of motherhood? And what are your creative outlets?
Oh, that's such a good question because I feel like I'm totally consumed in motherhood.
Me too.
Yeah. And like when they go to bed, I'm like on big little feelings and all, you know.
Looking at pictures of them too.
Yeah. And then I'm looking at pictures of them. Trying to find time to exercise, that doesn't always happen successfully, but that is definitely something that is for me that I love. And cooking and baking, I would say sometimes without them is also my time to refuge.
That's great. Do you involve them with cooking and baking too? Sometimes?
Yes, I do. But when I'm doing it by myself, it's very therapeutic.
What type of things do you like to cook and bake?
With them, I like to just go to like different like banana breads, like, you know, like muffins, the fun kind of baking treats. And then for cooking, really, we eat everything. Just anything you can imagine, we will try to cook.
I love when people bring up cooking because I do think that there's such a creative component to cooking and such a therapeutic component that in the day-to-day kind of monotony, people don't always think about. There's a big push for simple dinners and just straightforward kind of things. But I think when people can be creative with it and really take the time to enjoy it, I think that that's so special. So Jessie, thank you for being on with me. And I am so excited for this episode to air.
Same. Thank you for having me. I'm really happy for there to be a space in the community for secondary infertility because it's so difficult.
I agree. Thank you.
I hope you found this episode of the Secondary Infertility Podcast to be meaningful. One of the best ways to support me and my show is to rate and leave a review. For more secondary infertility content, please come find me at Holding Both on Instagram. That's HOLDINGBOTH on Instagram. Thank you.